Well, our Torah portion is called Balak, or Balak, and it begins in Numbers chapter 22. And even though it's named Balak, who is the king of the Moabites, the story is more about Balaam, this confusing prophet. Now, if you're confused by Balaam, I think you're supposed to be, because false prophets are very confusing. They are authors of confusion. But if you read the story of Balaam, and I'm going to trust that all of you as good Bible students have, his life is divided into three parts, and the rabbis recognize these three parts. The first part is where Balak sends to Balaam to ask him to come curse the Jewish people. Balak has looked out, he sees all these Jewish people, they've just been victorious in war, and they know now they're going to come from Moab, and so he calls this prophet Balaam to come and curse them. We're going to look at that in more detail in just a moment. The second phase is when Balaam comes and he's taken up and he looks over the people, and each time he goes to curse Israel, out of his mouth come blessings instead. In fact, the Ma Tovu that we sing every Sabbath morning, how goodly are your tents, O Jacob, your dwelling places, O Israel. These are the words that God spoke through Balaam's lips, and they're found here in this Torah portion. But the third part, and there's not as much information about this, but when Balaam failed to curse Israel, he did the next best thing. He told Balak how to put a stumbling block before them and to bring immorality and sexual temptation into their camp. And this worked. And there were thousands and thousands who died in Israel because of this. And this is the third thing Balaam did, the third part of the story. And you know, the New Testament writers recognize these three divisions. And if you go to 2 Peter for a moment, as I get myself arranged up here, and turn to chapter 2, verses 15 and 16. You'll find this passage. Peter's writing about people who have been in the congregation who turned out to be false believers or non-believers. They look like believers, but soon they were revealed as not being. And he says, forsaking the right way, they've gone astray. They have followed the way of Balaam, the son of Beor, who for gain from wrongdoing was rebuked for his own transgression. A speechless donkey spoke with human voice and restrained the prophet's madness. So here we see the way of Balaam. A way you could describe the way of Balaam in a nutshell is love of money. Love of money. And especially, not just the love of money around a run-of-the-mill non-believer, but a believer or someone who's gifted spiritually, who uses that, who prostitutes that for the sake of gain, or who just forsakes that to go after gain. I remember there was an older man who lived right down at the end of the street where I grew up. I think his was the first house built in the street. And compared to the other houses, it was like a mansion. It was just a big place. And he was always kind of weird, you know, and the kids kind of, he never talked to the kids. He seemed kind of mean. But one day he asked for some help for yard work and this and that and other thing. And so I got to kind of know him and his wife. He turned out to be a pretty nice guy after all. And he and his wife were remained friends for years, but as he began to share his life with me, he shared something I never forgot. He said when he was a young man, he said he felt God's call to go into the ministry. And he started to go, but then he thought, no, there's no money in it. And instead, he pursued wealth. And he got wealth. But he got something that's temporal instead of investing in a kingdom that's eternal. And that has always been something that's been in the back of my mind. Because I think anyone who's effective for the Lord, there's going to be a strong temptation to use those giftings for something that is just very temporal. That's the way of Balaam. But if you turn over a few pages, come to the book of Jude, which is just one chapter, Jude brings out the second phase of Balaam's life. And Jude, who's also talking in similar vein as Peter. In fact, one commentary on Jude I saw is called Jude, Acts of the Apostates, instead of the Apostles. And he refers to the error of Balaam. Woe to them, for they walked in the way of Cain and abandoned themselves for the sake of gain to Balaam's error and perished in Korah's rebellion. Remember we talked about Korah a few weeks ago? Now notice something here. He mentions Cain, Balaam, and Korah. And there's something, a few things actually, that all three of these men hold in common. One of them is they were all in a place of great privilege. Here's Cain, Adam's firstborn son. Here's Korah, who because of his position in the tribe of Levi, was part of the family of Levites. He got to carry the holy objects of the tabernacle. I often think of Korah as maybe being one who carried the Ark of the Covenant on his shoulder, but that wasn't good enough. He wanted more. Cain, being the firstborn son of Adam, that wasn't good enough. He wanted what Abel had, and when God had regard for Abel's sacrifice of the Cain's, he kills his brother. And then there's Balaam, who has this tremendous gifting of God. In fact, the rabbinic commentators say that Balaam was on the same kind of spiritual level as far as his giftings are concerned as Moses. But he took them into a selfish direction. You know, Moses could strike a rock and bring forth water, and we see Balaam striking his donkey and bringing out words of rebuke. But there are a lot of similarities, actually, if you look closely to their lives. And it can be very confusing for us, very confusing when you meet somebody who maybe knows the Bible, maybe has tremendous spiritual gifts, maybe has a lot of influence, and yet is tremendously wicked. These tend to mix. We don't think these can mix, but you know what? They do. We find them in people's lives, people who are tremendously wicked, but at the same time, they have these giftings of God. How could this be? Well, there are other examples of this, and it's something for you to do a study on your own. But consider Jannes and Jambres, who we spoke about last week in 2 Timothy 3:8. And how about Acts 8, Simon the sorcerer, who appears to become a believer, but when he sees the power of the apostles, he wants to give them money to get this ability from them. And here's a confusing one. How about the troublesome slave girl in Acts 16 who follows Paul and some of the apostles through the streets saying, listen to these men. They can tell you the way of God. They know the way of God. The way of salvation. Listen to them. But Paul got so annoyed because he realized this is a demonic spirit speaking through her. He turned and rebuked her and the spirit left her. And, well, you can read about all the trouble that caused. Don't be surprised. Don't try to understand it. You can't understand it. But don't be surprised when you find men or women who seem to have these tremendous spiritual giftings, great knowledge of the Word, maybe some special spiritual gift, and yet you see thorns and thistles growing out of them as well. It's unnatural, but it does happen. Balaam is a prime example of this. And then there's a third phase to Balaam's life. And when you go to the book of Revelation, Messiah is speaking to John there on the island of Patmos. And he says this. He's speaking about the church of Pergamum, if I'm not mistaken. And Yeshua says, but I have a few things against you. You have some there who hold the teaching of Balaam. Your Bibles may say the doctrine of Balaam. In Greek, the word for doctrine means teaching. Teaching of Balaam, who taught Balak to put a stumbling block before the sons of Israel so that they might eat food sacrificed to idols and practice sexual immorality. So Peter refers to the error of Balaam. Jude refers to the error of Balaam. The first one refers to the way of Balaam, then Jude to the error of Balaam, and then here in Revelation, the teaching of Balaam, which is the third thing that Balaam did in the story. The way of Balaam is love of money. The error of Balaam is no fear of God. No fear of God. And the third one, the teaching of Balaam, is indulging sensuality. Now, we're going to be talking about this third one more next week. In fact, to give you the end of the story, you have to understand what Balaam's outcome was in Numbers 31:16. It says, "Behold, these caused the children of Israel through the counsel of Balaam to commit trespass against the Lord in the matter of Peor. There was a plague among the congregation of the Lord." And then as you read on, you find out Balaam dies by the sword. And when the war finally broke out, Balaam dies. You need to know that. You need to understand the outcome of Balaam. In past years, I've taught about the prophecies of Balaam and how they're fulfilled, and there's so much there to study. You can never get to the bottom of it. But this week, I was just kind of led to look at this first part, this whole thing about the talking donkey. And I want us to focus on this because I think there's an amazing lesson here in this passage. So let's just jump right in, chapter 22, verse 2. Now, don't get Balak and Balaam confused. Balak's the king of Moab. Balaam's the false prophet, right? Balak, son of Zippor, saw all that Israel had done to the Amorite. Moab became very frightened of the people because it was numerous, afraid of the Israelites. And Moab was disgusted in the face of the children of Israel. Moab said to the elders of Midian. Now, Moab and Midian were historically enemies, but here they team up. You know, the enemy of my enemy is my friend. And they said, "Now the congregation, this group of Israelites, will lick up our entire surroundings as an ox licks up the greenery of the field." Balak, son of Zippor, was king of Moab at that time. He sent messengers to Balaam, son of Beor, to Petor, which is by the river of the land of the members of his people, to summon him, saying, "Behold, a people has come out of Egypt. Behold, it has covered the surface of the earth, and it sits opposite me. So now, please come and curse this people for me, for it is too powerful for me. Perhaps I will be able to strike it and drive it away from the land. For I know that whomever you bless is blessed, and whomever you curse is cursed." I think Balak was getting Balaam confused with God there. But Balak, he wasn't exactly a Torah student, was he? Verse 7, "The elders of Moab and the elders of Midian went with charms in their hand. They came to Balaam and spoke to him the words of Balak. He said to them, 'Spend the night here, and I shall give you a response, as Adonai, Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh, shall speak to me.' So the officers of Moab stayed with Balaam. God came to Balaam and said, 'Who are these men with you?'" Now, God never asks a question because he needs an answer. He asks the question because he wants you to ask the question of yourself. Who are these men really? And if Balaam was wise, you'd think, yeah, they want me to come and curse the people you've blessed, the people you've rescued out of Egypt. They want me to come and undo your work. But I don't know if Balaam ever put two and two together. Verse 10, "Balaam said to God, 'Balak, son of Zippor, king of Moab, sent to me. Behold, the people coming out of Egypt has covered the surface of the earth. Now go and curse it for me. Perhaps I will be able to make war against it and drive it away.' God said to Balaam, 'You shall not go with them. You shall not curse the people, for it is blessed.' Balaam arose in the morning, said to the officers of Balak, 'Go to your land, for Adonai refuses to let me go with you.' The officers of Moab arose and came to Balak and said, 'Balaam refused to go with us.'" Verse 15, "Balak kept on sending officers, more and higher ranking than these." He thinks, well, Balaam's just holding out for a better deal. "Balak kept on sending officers, more and higher ranking than these. They came to Balaam and said to him, 'So said Balak, son of Zippor, do not refrain from going to me, for I shall honor you greatly, and everything that you say to me I shall do. So go now and curse this people for me.' Balaam answered and said to the servants of Balak, 'If Balak will give me his house full of silver and gold, I cannot transgress the word of Adonai my God, Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh my Elohim, to do anything small or great. And now you too stay here for the night, and I will know what more Adonai will speak with me.' Now, Balaam didn't really need to go ask God a second time what God wanted him to do. In fact, I know there have been times in my life I keep asking God for something he said no to, and then finally he says yes, and then I'm really in trouble. And this is one of those cases. God came to Balaam at night and said to him, "If the men came to summon you, arise and go with them. But only the thing that I shall speak to you, that shall you do." Now stop there, don't read the next sentence. If you're Balaam, what are you going to do next? You're going to go to these messengers and say, "Okay, God spoke to me. He said, I can go with you, but I'm only going to speak what he tells me to say." And you got to know right up front, he's already blessed these people. But Balaam didn't do that. The very fact that it skips right on to the verse 21, Balaam arose in the morning, saddled his she-donkey, and went with the officers of Moab, means he probably didn't explain to them what God had said. So they're thinking, he's coming to curse the people. And Balaam's thinking, all right, I know what God said to me, but I'm not going to get any money unless I go. I'm going to try to work this out somehow. I'm going to try to stand in the middle. And I know what God has said, but I know the offer over here. I'm going to see what I can do. And that is always a dangerous place to be. Yes, Adam. The word there for bless is Baruch, okay, Barak. And for curse, well, it's interesting. Earlier, when they asked Balaam to come curse the people, they use one word. When Balaam goes before God, he misquotes them and uses a different word for curse. The word for curse that Balak originally used of Balaam is a mild one. It means basically to weaken the people, to break them down to where I can go in and conquer them. He's not asking Balaam to curse them so they all turn into chipmunks, you know, and then they can just ride over them. He's just saying, it's to weaken them. But when God says, what do these people say? What are these men there for? Balaam misquotes Balak and uses a different word for curse. And it's one that's much stronger, much harsher. And the rabbis tell us that from this, that Balaam is revealing his own anti-Semitism. And that deep-seated in Balaam must have been a hatred for the Jewish people for whatever reasons. So there are two different words for curse that are used here. So I don't know if that's helpful or not, but please say yes. Okay, thank you. Good. All right. Now here's where I want us to really look. You know, for years and years and years, this story of the talking donkey has been really confusing. You know, we find a talking serpent back in the Garden of Eden, and the enemy is speaking to the serpent, but here God is speaking through the donkey. And this story to me is much more confusing than the story in Genesis. Until I started hearing donkeys talk, and now it started to make more sense. Balaam arose in the morning and saddled his she-donkey and went with the officers of Moab. God's wrath flared because he was going. And an angel of the Lord stood on the road as an adversary. In Hebrew, that word is lesatan, the word for Satan. Now, don't get me wrong. It wasn't that the angel of the Lord came and imitated Satan. The word satan means to impede, to be an adversary, to put a roadblock, a speed bump in front of you, to work against you. And, you know, how many times in our lives do we go about rebuking Satan when it's not Satan, it's God's messenger who's sent to rebuke us? We need to be careful. We need to be careful. He was riding on his she-donkey, and his two young men were with him. Now, let's follow that very closely now at this point. Really focus. The she-donkey saw the angel of the Lord standing on the road with his sword drawn in his hand. So you get the picture? Balaam's on the donkey. Balaam doesn't see the angel. The donkey does. Some prophet, huh? And so the donkey, not wanting to die, it says, she turned away from the road and went into the field. Then Balaam struck the she-donkey to turn it back onto the road. Verse 24, the angel of the Lord stood in the path of the vineyards, a fence on this side and a fence on that side. This time the donkey can't escape into a field. The she-donkey saw the angel of the Lord and pressed against the wall, and it pressed Balaam's leg against the wall. And he continued to strike it. 26, the angel of the Lord went further and stood in a narrow place where there was no room to turn right or left. So what does the she-donkey do? The she-donkey saw the angel of the Lord and crouched beneath Balaam. Just kind of went flat. I guess you could say Balaam had a flat on his donkey when he's right. But Balaam's anger flared and he struck the she-donkey with the stick. First time it runs into a field. Next time it's in a lane where it can kind of squeeze around or try to go to one side or the other. Then finally it's so confined, you can't go left, can't go right. You certainly can't go straight ahead. So the donkey just goes down. And so Balaam's wailing away on this donkey with his stick. Verse 28. The Lord opened the mouth of the she-donkey, and it said to Balaam, "What have I done to you that you struck me these three times?" Balaam said to the she-donkey, "Because you mocked me. If only there were a sword in my hand, I would now have killed you." The she-donkey said to Balaam, "Am I not your she-donkey that you have ridden all your life until this day? Have I been accustomed to do such a thing to you?" He said, "No." Then the Lord uncovered Balaam's eyes, and he saw the angel of the Lord standing on the road with his sword drawn in his hand. He bowed his head and prostrated himself on his face. I guess you could say now there are two donkeys on the ground. The angel of the Lord said to him, "For what reason did you strike your she-donkey these three times? Behold, I went out as an adversary, for you hastened on a road to oppose me. The she-donkey saw me and turned away from me these three times. Had it not turned away from me, I would now have killed you and let it live." Balaam said to the angel of the Lord, "I've sinned, for I did not know that you were standing opposite me on the road. And now if it is evil in your eyes, I shall return." Now here's what makes this story especially strange. God didn't have to do any of this. If he didn't want Balaam going, he could have just appeared to Balaam right there at the beginning. None of the talking donkey business, none of the running into the field, and just, you know, Balaam, and he's got to sort out, "Balaam, don't do this. You take another step, I'm going to kill you." That's all he had to do. Why all this stuff, going into the field, going into the wall, collapsing, getting beat, talking, and then finally God reveals himself? Well, Paul tells us that all scripture, including this story, is profitable for doctrine, for teaching, for reproof, correction, for instruction in righteousness. That the man of God may be perfect, mature, thoroughly furnished to every good work. And so if God did this in this particular way, it has particular things to teach us that we need to learn from. Now, as we analyze this, what is a donkey? This donkey is something reliable. It's been reliable since Balaam was a youth. Something he could count on to provide service. It was submissive. It was obedient. It did what Balaam had, always had done. But now it all kind of goes crazy. It's not complying. It's not cooperating. If you had things in your life that you always could rely on, they were just as reliable as your Timex, you know, they just went well and you just took it for granted, and then something happens in your life and it's all going wrong. It just isn't working. You're getting frustrated. You're getting angry and thinking, "Why isn't everything going my way? What have I done? What's the problem here?" We've all been there. We've all been in Balaam's shoes, right? And then we get out our stick, which might be our mouth. It might be something else. We just want to strike out. We just want to punish. We're just angry. We're frustrated. And we start displaying this anger. at our surroundings. I guess you could say the donkey's like our circumstances, that all of a sudden, that used to be okay, and now they're not. It's all gone haywire. It's all gone belly up. Now, what you have to realize is that it's not the circumstances, there's an invisible hand behind the circumstances. The donkey is just sitting beside, you know, I just feel ornery today. It didn't do that. It was responding to the invisible. And when your circumstances start going haywire, it's because there's an invisible hand at work. We have a God who Isaiah says, you are a God who hides himself. But our hidden God, our invisible God, he runs the world. And when your circumstances start going a little haywire, realize there's an invisible hand behind the circumstances. And if you learn to recognize that, your circumstances can begin to talk to you. And you'll notice that everything the donkey says is not in the form of a statement, but in the form of a question. The donkey doesn't tell Balaam what he's done wrong. The donkey doesn't talk about the angel. The donkey doesn't talk about God, the meaning of the universe and life. And it just simply asks questions. What does it say? In verse 28, what have I done to you that you struck me these three times? Verse 30, am I not your she-donkey that you have ridden all your life until this day? Have I been accustomed to do such a thing to you? The donkey doesn't tell Balaam anything. It simply is asking questions that Balaam has to answer. And when your circumstances, your job, your health, the whatever it is that's frustrating you to death right now, let it ask the questions. And when we begin to answer the questions, we'll begin to see the invisible hand behind the circumstances. Let me give you a concrete example. I could give you many. But it's a principle I've come to rely on in my life. And it's never, ever failed me. You know, a couple years ago, about a year and a half ago, we decided to take the house that we used to live in and we decided to rent it because the market went out and we decided, well, we'll just rent it. And so we, you know, talked to some people and finally a young lady, probably mid-early, I guess to me she's young, mid-30s, and a fine Christian girl just came over and she says, this would just be perfect for my needs. And she wanted her elderly mother with health problems to move in with her. And she had a younger brother who had had some issues, but she wanted to get the whole family under one roof. This would be perfect, ideal. She signs the paper. She gives a security deposit, blah, 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 blah. Everything looks great. A month or two into the lease, she loses her job. And she comes to us, you know, I can't make this payment. What should I do? We decide, okay, we'll just lower it. But then pretty soon, those payments were late, and then they were just partial. And then we found out the brother is selling drugs, using drugs, selling drugs out of the house, in trouble with the law. And mom is helping him. She's got prescriptions that she doesn't need, and she's giving them to him to sell on the street. And the place just turned into a sty until finally the young lady we rented to had to move out herself. And there's mom, and there's brother. And and to make it all worse, we had these raccoons infesting. They were pulling out the overhang, and they were crawling up in there just having a grand old time up inside our roof. And everything's growing up. And this home that we'd lived in for 13 years, a beautiful place, it's just like, it's where Beth the Coon started, in fact. It's just like, look at this. And I'd pray, and I'd call a lawyer, what do I do? And this, and finally, it's like, one day, it's just like this, I won't say it's a voice, but this awareness in my heart. I'm laying in bed, I remember the night so well. I reached into my ear, I don't know what to do. And then it's like a voice said, Grant, that house is you. And as soon as that awareness hit, I knew that the house wasn't the problem. The house was the mirror. I was the problem. I had things in my life that God didn't want there. Because you see, this house that's me, I'm just a tenant here. The house belongs to God. And I had people, I had things living in my house of brick and mortar I didn't want there. And God's telling me, you've got things in your house I don't want there. And so instead of trying to get the people removed, I worked on me instead. It's like the rabbi says, if you look in the mirror and your hand is crooked, don't adjust the mirror. And I did business with God. I shared with Robin. I'm sorry, I don't know why I'm getting all choked up here. I'm getting so chickish in my old age. But you know what? 2 weeks, they were gone. Gone, moved, just out. They were determined to stay there, and just 2 weeks later, house is empty. House is empty. When I evicted the squatters in my life, the reflection changed. And you might say, well, Grant, that's ridiculous. That is absurd. That is nuts. That makes no sense. I mean, it seems scientifically. You're telling me God's going to put three people in that house and raccoons and this and that and everything just to be a reflection of something inside of you? And I know it's absurd. I know it's ridiculous. I know it makes no physical sense. But see, welcome to the world of talking donkeys. The absurdity of this story of a donkey that's always been reliable now asking questions. Is that any more absurd than a house of brick and mortar being a reflection of this house? I've had people call me. Sometimes problems with their kids. Oh, my daughter's driving me crazy. She doesn't do this, doesn't do that. She's lazy. She's not good. What's going on? And all I have to do is think, okay, the daughter is a reflection of something. And as I begin to share, your daughter has learned this from you. Because in your life, since you've asked, I've noticed spiritually you've been lazy. You've not been obedient to your Father in heaven. You've not been studying His Word. And yet you want your child to work and be obedient and to study, but you're not doing that. You change your soul, and then let's see what the image in the mirror does to change. You understand? And remember, the circumstances don't tell you your problem. They simply cause you to ask questions. It causes you to stop and think. And when you do, just as Balaam's eyes were opened to see the invisible, to see the angel of the Lord, your eyes can be opened to see the hidden hand, the invisible hand behind your life, behind your circumstances, behind all your frustrations. And you're going to find all those things are out there. They weren't there because of karma or because of the devil. They were God's hand at work, simply mirroring the things that are unseen in your own life. Now, guys, being a guy, I want to tell you something. Don't misuse this principle. Because you see, the greatest frustration in your life, whatever the thing is that comes to mind, is always floating to the front of your mind that you're so frustrated with. Oh, it's just driving me crazy. That's the mirror. That's the image in the mirror. But guys, we all drive our wives crazy. Who said that? Who said amen? Oh. Ushers? No. Guys, we all drive our wives crazy. And when you realize your wife's getting really irritated with you, whatever you do, don't say, honey, I'm your mirror. You need to fix. That's bad. Don't do that. Trust me. Don't do that. All right? Don't misuse this principle. When you're walking through the house in the dark, barefoot, you stub your toe. I mean, don't all say, Lord, what are you trying to show me? He's trying to show you, turn the lights on when you walk through the house at night. You know, I mean, a lot of times they're just consequences of bad judgment, and it's very simple. But what are the things that are just eating at you that seem like they're mocking you, that almost seems supernaturally be going against your will, the things that used to submit to your authority and used to just comply with your wishes, and now they just don't work. That's the thing you need to look at and start thinking, all right, maybe this isn't the problem in my life. This is just a mirror of the problem in my life. And I need to change what's on this side of the mirror, and then the image on that side of the mirror will change as well. And if we learn to do that, I think you're going to find this to be a very, very effective way of changing your own soul. I know for me, it's been annoyingly consistent and faithful. And, you know, for us, what we want to do, we look in the mirror and we see something that's repulsive. We want to take the mirror back to get the mirror fixed. Can you imagine how stupid that would be? Some woman taking her bathroom mirror back to the store and says, I want to get this mirror replaced. So what's wrong? Well, I get up in the morning, I look in it, and all I see is ugly. And the guy says, you are ugly, you know? And so you follow what I'm saying? It's Ben, you had your hand up. Yes, sir. Any other questions? I think the questions are mainly to get us to see this isn't just coincidence. This is something more. And the donkey is getting Balaam to ask, look, I've always been reliable. Now I'm not. I've always been submissive. Now I'm not. I always took you where you wanted to go. Now I don't. In fact, I'm bringing confusion. I'm bringing pain. And I'm bringing embarrassment into your life. Okay? We begin to think, all right, there's an invisible hand, and we begin to go to God. But the key is to realize the way to change that is for me to change me. The only soul in this world you can fix and you can change is your own. And we do a botched job of that most of the time. That's the only soul you can work on and change. It's just your own. But I've been amazed over and over and over and over again when my kids are driving me crazy, I started to change me. And when other things in my life are driving me nuts, I begin to change me. That's the bizarreness of the story, and that's the bizarreness of how this life tends to work. And you know what? You look at the story, and here's Balaam. He's ready to kill his donkey. But what he doesn't realize, here's God ready to kill Balaam. And his donkey collapses in the dirt when he has no further he can go, she can go. But when Balaam's eyes are open, he collapses in the dirt. The frustration he's experiencing with this donkey is the frustration, if God feels frustration, that he's feeling towards Balaam. Balaam wants the donkey to do his will. God wants Balaam to speak forth his will. And after this episode, Balaam did. His heart hadn't changed, but the words came out of his mouth are the most beautiful prophecies of the Messiah and the Messianic kingdom that are found anywhere in the Torah. It's an amazing thing to look at. Jim, your hand was up. Oh, all right. Well, what was the question?
In verse 18,
he was no more born again than the donkey was. God could speak through a donkey. God can speak through a Balaam. But I'm sure the donkey's heart wasn't right with God. And we know Balaam's wasn't.
Why
Okay, let me put it this way. Let's ask the question, why does God use such a false prophet? And we'll finish with this. The rabbis write about this. Why is it the most beautiful messianic prophecies in the Torah come out of the mouth of this wicked person who eventually counsels Balak on how to trip up the people of Israel and cause them to stumble in this sexual immorality? Well, why is it that God uses like the filthiest, wickedest person he could find to speak the most wonderful and beautiful things that about the Messiah and the Messianic kingdom found in the Torah? Well, I think in the apostolic scriptures, we find a similar parallel. We find Yeshua, who's perfect, the Son of God, the Messiah, the flawless one, the Word made flesh. And he comes, he lives a life, he dies on the cross for our sins to bring forgiveness and deliverance. And then after his resurrection, he ascends into heaven. And then who does God call to spread this news? The chief of sinners. When Paul said he's the chief of sinners, I don't think he was exaggerating. I don't think it was false humility. I think he was, because he had all the education. He knew the Torah. He knew the traditions. He knew the writings. He had the books of wisdom. And he had even seen the proofs of Messiah's resurrection. He had seen his apostles and hardened his heart against all of that. And he's there holding the cloak when the first martyr, Stephen, is stoned. And then he goes out to persecute this way. I think when he says the chief of sinners, he meant I'm the chief of sinners. So here God uses the most holy person who ever lived to bring salvation to the world and uses the chief of sinners to announce that salvation to the world. Of course, Paul's heart's changed, whereas Balaam's wasn't. But it's amazing how God will use these contrasts to show that he runs the world. And whether it's true or not, the Talmud tells us that Balak, the one who wanted to have Israel cursed and wiped out and destroyed, right? He hires Balaam. Balaam comes and speaks forth these wonderful prophecies, these beautiful prophecies. Balak himself became an ancestor of the Moabitess Ruth, who was the great-grandmother of King David, who is the ancestor of the son of David, Yeshua himself. You know, that's so beautiful, not so perfect, it's got to be true. It just has to be true. Can you prove it? No, but I have to believe it. And so this wicked man, Balak, is used to bring the Messiah into the world. And this wicked man, Balaam, is used to announce the Messiah and his kingdom. You see, when you have a God like that, you really can't lose. You really can't lose. And the things in your life that are going wrong and frustrating, you know what? The invisible hand behind them, he's faithful, he's good. And like I always say, he can bring roses out of manure. And where sin abounds, grace much more abounds. We have a wonderful God, and this is the way he works. It's an incredible principle. It's an incredible principle. So don't you dare ever think, God can't use me, I'm too bad. No, out of that manure in your life, and there's manure there, that just makes the soil all the richer to bring forth fruit. This is the God we have. He's not threatened by your past and your sin. Not an excuse to commit it. He's not threatened by it. And he'll bring about good in your life. Ken, we're going to give you the last word, and we're going to close.
The 1-3, I'm thinking of Acts 10 and Messiah 3:19. Why didn't he ask him, why 3, right and left?
I don't know. Why 3? It's always... I don't know. 3 is one of the numbers of completion. 7 is a number of completion. 10 is another. 12 is another. But there are completions of different things. And but it seems like things come in threes. We just tend to. Yeah. But if I ever get an answer for that, then I'll let you know. I have so many questions. You guys are asking the same questions I do so many times. But so let's close in prayer, and then we invite you to Oneg. Boaz and Toby will be joining us for Oneg. You can meet them, and... autographs are free today because it's the Shabbat. They can't sell autographs. But so let's have a word of prayer. We'll do the blessing and you'll be dismissed. Father, thank you so much again for your many blessings to us. Thank you for your word, your holy Torah, for it is truly a lamp to our feet, a light to our path. Help us to look deeply into your word. Father, I pray that as we look into it, we wouldn't just hear the words, but deep down we'll realize that they're being sung. Help us to hear the melody behind your holy words. And so we can rejoice with your Torah in a whole deeper and newer way. We praise you for it. And Lord, I pray these words will help us to be more faithful, more obedient, more submissive to you, to be people of light. We ask this in the precious name of the light of the world, Yeshua himself. Amen.